Welcome to the Ouch Talk Show. It's a disability thing. I'm Kate Monaghan.
And I'm Simon Minty. In this impairment-packed hour, we're joined by three people who are all about speaking up and speaking out.
We'll meet them in mere minutes. But first, Simon, what have you been up to this month, hey? This dreary month of January.
It's been a bit torrid. I've had sort of people, family deaths and people acquiring disabilities. And then my flat was flooded. Mm. On the upside, I booked a trip to Thailand.
Okay, good. I don't really know how to react now because some of that was so bad that I can't then go, yay, Thailand!
Yeah, okay,
what do you want from me?
I don't know.
You don't know?
Just
okay.
Acknowledgement.
Sad, but happy.
It's been a tough one, I must confess. It's been a really tough start.
Acquiring new disabilities, people who have acquired new disabilities.
Yeah.
And are you able to help them out with that?
Of course, and I've met with them and I've spent time with them, but I think that adjustment is pretty full on and can take some time. And you know, it's that change of life and they've got to look at kit and so all the practical things I can do. But some of the emotional stuff I think is quite tough. How about you? What's been happening?
Oh, well, a programme I made almost this time last year.
Because you make programmes as well, don't you?
I do make TV programmes.
Go on.
For a living. Well, kind of for a living. For an almost living. It went on air in the last week or so.
What's it about?
Well, Simon, I'm so glad you asked. It's on CBBC and it's called My Life, How We Roll. And
we're running out of time, I'm afraid.
It's about kids in America who do wheelchair skating or wheelchair BMXing. And it is
stop it.
Like quite
the
incredible.
Paralympics opening and the guy who flips.
Yeah, so Wheels, he is, I could say he's a friend of mine. I know him reasonably well now.
Name drop.
Yeah. Yeah. So he started the sport and all of these kids are following in his footsteps. He's in the programme as well because he's like world number one, amazing.
And the theory being if they fall out, they can't become, they're already disabled, so it doesn't matter. Is that?
One of the kids actually says that. She says, well, what's the worst that can happen? I'm already in a wheelchair.
It's so a very standard wheelchair gag.
Exactly. And it's available now on iPlayer.
Well, I might. Well, I don't know if I will, but I could watch that.
You should watch that.
Yeah.
It's a really good show. Whose was that?
It was my watch telling me to breathe.
In case you forget.
It's really annoying sometimes. It really stresses me out.
Anyway, I mean, it's not all about us, this show, much as we'd like it to be. Disability rights activist and writer Emily Ladau is on Skype from New York. Hi, Emily.
Hi, how are you?
I'm really good. I mean, I'm afraid that the disability rights activist and writer, that does not make you a cool kid. However, you were on Sesame Street and that does make you a cool kid.
I had to get my street cred from somewhere. That's where I got it.
How did you get that gig?
I actually went to a summer camp for kids with disabilities and the talent manager called and asked for kids to audition. So somehow I got roped into it and ended up on the show.
Amazing.
Oh, that's not extreme. Have you done anything extreme, like the kind of wheelchair skating?
No, I'm a little bit terrified of that, but I'm a pretty big fan of Aaron Fotheringham, so if you can hook a girl up, you know, wink, wink.
Oh, yes, I can. We shall talk later. I'm forever trying to get that boy paired up with somebody.
Blind entrepreneur and presenter of new Channel 4 show How to Get Fit Fast, Amar Latif is on the line from Leeds. So what's the most extreme thing you've done, Amar?
Jumped out of a plane.
Oh, all right, show off. I mean, blimey.
I mean, you know, accidentally, because I'm blind, I was just going to the toilet and opened the wrong door.
Yay, you're getting all the credit. As well as jumping out of the plane, you were also on that show, I don't know how long ago this was, the Beyond Boundaries, where they got disabled people to put them in the most inappropriate environment and see how you got on.
Are there any disabled people who haven't been on Beyond Boundaries?
I was the first one, though, weren't you?
Oh, okay.
Yes, so it was the first series where 11 of us had to cross Nicaragua, 220 miles from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean. And yeah, it was quite an incredible challenge. That was a strange one because there was blind, deaf, wheelchairs, people missing limbs. So, you know, if there was a plane crash on the way there, they probably wouldn't know what bits we had and what we didn't.
Was that with Sophie Morgan and Adi Adapitan? And was that
That's
your...
right. Wow. Yeah.
All the big names.
Well, I was pushing Addy, and then when I got bored of that, I was pushing Sophie across on a wheelchair.
There was this sort of slightly inspirational bit, which made me go a bit weird, but I do also remember seeing Addy get out of the chair and just kind of pull himself up the mountain. And you're like, oh, my goodness me, that was kind of full on.
That's right, because we had a set time for when to get up, and so we started pushing Addy's wheelchair up a 45-degree angle, up a 5,000-foot slope, but then it was getting really tricky. I was blind and I was pushing this wheelchair up the mountain, and then Addy just said, right, I'll get in my chair. But that was incredible.
You're not
so
going
much
fast
passion.
Enough. With us in the studio is Mandy Stevens. Hi, Mandy.
Hi, good evening.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. She's that mental health director working for the NHS. You may have heard her because she's been in the news a fair bit recently.
Sorry.
Because she has recently been hospitalised for depression, and her LinkedIn post about the experience went viral. How do you get something that goes viral? What's your top tip? People are always saying, oh, let's make this go viral. How did you do it?
I really didn't expect this to go viral at all. It was the last thing I had in my mind. When I was depressed and in hospital, I only told, like, 7 people.
Yeah.
And then on the 27th of December, when I came out on leave, I thought, oh, you know, I'll reach out to my friends on Facebook and told 200-300 friends on Facebook. And then I thought, well, you know, my professional colleagues and stuff, you know, who work in mental health, I'll let them know as well, thinking a couple of hundred people might read it. And people just started reading, liking, sharing. And by the first evening, it had 15,000 views. And I was flabbergasted, wow. Absolutely flabbergasted.
Now, let's go back to the start. So for anyone who hasn't caught your story, what happened to you last November?
The first symptom that I had is I had a meeting with my boss, and I get on really well with my boss. And at the end of the meeting, I said, is it OK if I have a couple of weeks off over Christmas? And the back of my eyes started getting hot and wet, you know, like when you're about to start crying. And I thought, well, I never cry at work. What's that about? And she looked at me, and I just sort of kind of got really upset. And that's very unusual for me. So she asked me how I was, and I said, yeah, I'm fine. And I got home and I did something called the Beck's Depression Inventory, which is something I've used as a clinician. And it's basically 22 questions, yes, no sort of thing. And it said that I was mild to moderately depressed. So I booked in to see a private psychiatrist who I've seen a few times before. I saw her the next day, and she prescribed some antidepressants and said that I should have some therapy. And I just got very ill, very, very, very quickly. So I saw the psychiatrist the next week, and she said, you know, Mandy, you're really ill. You know, you kind of need to come into hospital.
So you went from having a cry, like a little cry at work,
yeah,
to the following week being so ill you had to go into hospital.
Yeah.
Was there a trigger? Was there anything you could put your finger on?
So what I've been really reflecting on now that I'm well is looking at warning symptoms and looking at signs beforehand. So things like becoming socially isolated and, you know, hiding behind work and saying I'm OK when I'm not OK, not reaching out to people, all these sort of things were happening, but I wasn't noticing because I was a busy director in the NHS.
So you really didn't... And when we read the show notes, and there was that bit about you fill in the questionnaire and then this rapid descent. I think, did that give you permission?
So I think what happens with clinical depression is when clinical depression gets hold of you, it affects different people different ways. But so the following Friday, you know, so this was like 8 days or whatever later, I had an assessment with the crisis team at my local hospital, and they said, you know, you need to come into hospital. And I said, no, I'll be fine. And I keep my kind of suit of armour on, and I, you know, I'm a director, so everything's fine and mental health can't affect me. And I went to work on the Monday morning. I had a terrible weekend and went to work on the Monday morning, put my suit on and had the executive meeting, and I was OK. And then I had to then take quite a long drive, and I just thought, I can't do this. I'm broken. I actually cannot do this. So I phoned the crisis team, and she said, you know, come in and we'll get a bed for you. And I just thought, I can't be admitted to hospital. I'm a director. And I went in and I was admitted.
So the bit where you've gone out and said, don't worry about stigma, but when you're suddenly in it, you couldn't kind of acknowledge that past where you said, this is OK.
I knew I was depressed, but I didn't know how depressed I was. And also, because when I went into hospital, I thought, oh, I'll be in for 2 or 3 days, just a crisis admission. And what happened is I just got a lot worse. So everything that I'd kind of hidden inside and everything that I'd kind of compressed suddenly kind of erupted. And I got, you know, very, very ill very quickly. I was you know, I went from having thoughts about self-harm to being actively suicidal, which is extremely frightening and horrible.
Does that happen a lot when people go into hospital?
Hospital's a very safe place, and I was very, very, very lucky to be living in the borough of Hackney. So my local hospital is East London NHS Foundation Trust, and there's only two mental health trusts in the whole country that are outstanding by the Care Quality Commission, and this is outstanding. So the care was really fantastic. So the nurses were very present and they were talking to me a lot, and the psychologist and the psychiatrist and everything were just really working with me. So it enabled me to kind of really release all these emotions that were there.
And so you went to be an inpatient, and what was life like? And did you sometimes have moments where you're thinking, I'm still a director, I'm observing this, but hang on, I'm in this, having it happen to me too?
I very much went through a cycle. It's quite a classic cycle. And what I know about depression, I'm 100% sure that when I get depression, my depression will lift because this is my personality. Mm. My depression has now lifted and it's OK. I've got a bit of residual anxiety, which I am absolutely hating, but that will go soon as well. So I knew, even when I was really depressed, so for 4 weeks, I was not really washing, I wasn't looking after myself, I was monosyllabic, I could hardly speak, I was, you know, just wandering around in a daze. No,
this is on the ward.
This is when I was on the ward and crying all the time and thinking about death and morbid thoughts and everything. But then after that, I kind of went through the cycle of, you know, I got put on a lot of medication. So the antidepressants started working. And then I had 3 very miserable weeks where I was coming out of depression and realising kind of where I was and what was going on. But my biggest symptom then was something called anhedonia. So hedonism is when you enjoy yourself and you love life.
Kate,
and that's
knows
me.
That.
Oh, I know
okay.
all about that. Oh, yeah.
So I'm a hedonist. I love life. I really enjoy myself. And on the sort of Myers-Briggs scale of extrovert, I'm 9 out of 10 for extrovert. I'm, you know, always smiling. And then I had these awful 3 weeks where nothing was fun. Everything was miserable and boring. And I remember asking to see the doctor, and I wanted to kind of shake him and say, I'm not normally a miserable old cow, you know, just I normally smile and have fun.
How did they...
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead, Amar.
Do you think going to hospital made things worse? Did you suddenly think, oh my God, I'm in a hospital situation, there is something major wrong with me? I mean, if you hadn't gone to hospital, I wonder how it would have developed.
So I had, thanks for the question, I had the same, kind of about 4 years ago, I got quite depressed, and I was with the same psychiatrist, and she told me to come into hospital, and I said, no, I don't want to come into hospital because I know how ill I can get, you know, I know I'm just so worried about it. And at the time I was director of nursing in another trust and I clung on to work. The chief exec was really supportive. And even though I had social phobia and depression, I still went to work. So this time I overstepped the mark. I felt I was on a precipice. So that Monday lunchtime, I knew that I was broken and I had to go into hospital. I just had no other choice. When I got into hospital, what happened is it enabled me to talk about the things I needed to talk about and to let all these emotions out. So things like crying and crying in public and talking about really horrible, sad, terrible things, it was like the first time I'd ever done it. And I'd always bottled it up before because, you know, that's just what we do and, you know...
Now, as a TV maker, it kind of comes across almost like a TV programme. Did anyone on the ward think, you know, oh, there's this mental health director, she's suddenly a patient.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah.
Am I on a TV programme?
Back to the shop floor,
exactly.
They call it,
yeah,
don't they?
Exactly. Yeah, like the Truman Show, what's it called? The boss something or other, undercover
yes.
cop.
Or undercover millionaire, secret millionaire, you know, all of this kind of stuff,
yes.
Undercover boss.
Mixing quite a few shows now.
Is it
Sesame Street?
No, it did, because obviously I've worked as a mental health nurse for many years. I'm still a registered mental health nurse and I'm really proud of my profession. And the guy guys at East London Foundation Trust really did us proud. They really looked after us. But I would also be watching them and the way they were looking after the other ladies on the ward. I was on a single-sex ward, which I was really glad about.
How many other people?
There was 20 ladies on the ward altogether. And because it covers the borough of Hackney, it was an extremely diverse bunch of ladies on the ward. Mm. We had black English, black African, we had American, we had Eastern European, we had some ladies who didn't speak English. We had Muslim, Jewish, Christian, old, young, a complete mixture.
Goodness me.
So you could go to bed at 9 o'clock one night, and then the next morning there'd be another three different ladies on the ward. And some people would come in via the police, some people would come in extremely ill and shouting and screaming and, you know, causing a lot of trouble. And other people like me would just come in and crying and, you know, it was just... But because I'm experienced in mental health from being a nurse, I wasn't surprised by it. But if I hadn't worked in mental health, it probably would have been a bit frightening.
Were you looking at that as a patient or were you looking at that as a director of improvement?
Yeah, so for the first 4 weeks, I had no eye contact with anyone. I didn't care. I wouldn't have cared about anything. I was just looking at the floor and sad and crying. Then when I had the kind of 3 weeks, I was kind of looking around a bit more and making relationships with the staff. And then towards the end, that's when I began to feel a bit like undercover cop, because also I'd be sitting with these ladies like in the lounge and in the living areas and, you know, talking about everything and talking about mental health and the blue pill and what does the white pill do and what's your diagnosis, and ladies who cut their arms and ladies who self-harm and ladies with anorexia, and they weren't seeing me as a nurse or a director or a threat. They were seeing me as a friend and somebody who made them a cup of tea when they were feeling ill.
So they were kind of a lot more comfortable.
Completely,
talking.
Yeah.
What about that? When I've spoken to people who've been institutionalised, they'll say one of the biggest things is you lose your voice. And I mean, you're a senior director,
yeah.
And when I say lose your voice, I mean you're not taken seriously, mm-hmm. or you ask for things and people, yeah. Oh, no, that's part of your mental health. Did you have a sense of that?
So I was in East London Foundation Trust, and they were brilliant.
So they're excellent.
Yeah, they really are. So within the CQC, there's four ratings. This is the top rating. So I potentially, if I'd lived two streets away, I could have been admitted to any of five other trusts in London, and my experience may have been, I'm not saying would, but may have been completely different. But I can remember, I'd say, I don't feel I'm on the right medication, or I'd like to discuss this, and they would arrange for me to see a pharmacist or a junior doctor or a review with a consultant, and I really felt valued and listened to.
Presumably then, so that diverse group of women you were with, did you also then think, I can navigate this because I know the system, but if they don't know how to work this...
Absolutely.
...they need help with that.
And this is how I'm really benefiting. Now I've been discharged, I'm kind of as busy as I've ever been, because I know where to go, I know how to access different services, I'm using charity, voluntary, I'm using NHS services, so I'm really, really lucky, whereas somebody
who
didn't...
You're not back at work yet, though.
No. I've decided to take 3 months off to focus on my recovery, which is a really important thing to do, because I'm still, I hate to admit it, but I'm still fragile.
I'm saying with a big smile again. The arm is still there.
I'd much rather just be Mandy and just be back to me. So when I first came out of hospital and people were saying, hi, how are you? I know what they wanted to hear was, I'm fine, thanks.
Yeah.
So my answer was, I'm fine, thanks. But then I started getting anxious or feeling sick or having anxiety reactions, which are very new to me. So I changed it. And when people said, how are you? I'd say, I'm really glad that I'm through the dark days, but I'm still a bit fragile and I've got a bit of a way to go yet.
Can I ask you, you talked a lot at the start about your work in mental health, meaning that you were very proud of it. So I assume that when you went into hospital, you had no problem telling people where you were and what was wrong with you?
So because I had depression sucks the life out of you, and it makes you the opposite of, for me, I'll talk for me, it made me the opposite of who I am. So as an extrovert, I spent 3 weeks sort of hidden in my bedroom crying and not wanting to see anybody and not wanting to interact with anybody. So I didn't talk to anybody other than my mum, my two sisters and my three closest friends. That
I was
just
about
it.
To say, is it family or friends?
Just those people and nobody else. And I didn't want, it wasn't because I was embarrassed, I just I didn't want any drama. I didn't want anyone to contact me. I'd sit there crying in my bedroom, and my best friend, Pad, phoned me every single day I was in hospital, and I never answered the phone. And I'd be in my bedroom crying, and I'd see her face and her name on my phone, and I wouldn't pick it up. Because that's what depression does to you. Mm. And normally we'll chat and FaceTime for hours and hours all the time, and I just couldn't.
But presumably because she's a good friend, now you're speaking to her and she's totally cool anyway.
Oh, completely. And she'd come and visit me every week. Right. You know, she's a single mum of three kids, and she'd travel for 3 hours, like my mum, to come and visit me every week. So I had a lot of love. But when you're that depressed, it's very, very, very difficult to reach out. And I wouldn't answer emails, I wouldn't answer text messages, I'd turn my phone off and not want any communication. When you're that sad and depressed and, you know, it's just awful, terrible.
Mandy, this is Amber again. Is depression for you like a cycle, like a wave, like it starts and then it stops soon after? I mean, it isn't, because I know some people with depression and often it just lasts for a long time. Is there different types of depression?
There are different types of depression. And sort of with my clinical experience, what I know about myself is that I will get 100% well, because my personality is not a depressed personality. So for me, it's a clinical illness. Like somebody gets a chest infection, you take antibiotics and the chest infection goes. So for me, even when I was really depressed and really suicidal, I knew the depression would go. So I've had what you'd call mild to moderate depression about 3 times, and it's normally reactive, so like a couple of years after my dad died and a few other bits and pieces like that. And then I've had what I would call severe depression once before, which was about 4 years ago, and that was the one I said, you know, I should have been admitted, but I chose not to be. But some people get much more rapid cycling depression than that, and some people have bipolar, so they get depressed and then manic, depressed then manic. And some people just have generally a low mood, and that's their personality. And some people just have long-term depression that they don't treat and they don't look after themselves, and then they live an unhealthy lifestyle, and then they become socially isolated and overeat and smoke and drink, and then they just stay depressed for years and years and years and years. So different people have very different responses. And I think with my clinical background, I knew immediately to get help. I knew immediately to take antidepressants, immediately to start therapy. And then when I knew it was time to go into hospital, I went into hospital.
What do you think you've learned from this? Because you've now been on the inside. Mm. And going to go back to work. Are you now an evangelist? Are you saying, actually, I've learned a lot that I never picked up? What have you taken
Absolutely.
Away from this?
Absolutely. So one of the things that's amazing about the LinkedIn thing that's gone viral is I've been contacted by work colleagues from the past 30 years. So people who've known me as a student or as a matron or as a hospital director, all really, really, really giving me support. And everyone's saying, you know, I've been offered a job. You know, everything's kind of like, it's
your big break.
but so what I've there are things that I would do differently, and but I've always been passionate about people. My motto as a nurse has been, you put people first, and so you put your patients first, then you put your staff second, and then you put the money third. Now, different people, so if you had the finance director in the room, you'd be staring at me and arguing. Yeah.
But I want to push, because that's still a bit directory for me. That I'm kind of about you personally. Have you kind of thought, oh, my goodness me, I didn't realise that bit? Or now when I will talk about this stigma, the depth of knowledge will be different.
So there's things that I have really appreciated and valued, like psychology on the inpatient ward, for example, and that's talked about all the time. Mental health care is underfunded across the country. We don't have enough beds, and that the previous trusts that I've worked in, we've had to move patients from, you know, 10 or hundreds of miles away because there aren't any beds. So if I'd been admitted to another trust, I might have been admitted literally to Portsmouth or Northampton, or to a private clinic in South London, and then move back and then change to a different ward, and my consultant and team would have changed 3 times. So imagine how different my experience would have been. But instead, I had a fantastic team around me. So what that has taught me is about how important it is to have the relationship as a patient, to have some patients like to be called service users. I'm very happy with being called a patient. Sure. So when I was a patient on the ward, you know, having familiar staff coming in and knowing me and looking after me and supporting me, people that I could trust, having access to psychological therapy on the ward, having great occupational therapy and OT groups, we had service user groups, discussion groups. So some of the things that are quite easy when the budget is tight, you think, well, let's just, you know, knock off 0.5 of a psychologist, or let's just get one OT to cover four wards. Actually, I've now experienced that those are the things, apart from the fantastic, wonderful nurses, those are the things that really helped me with my recovery on the ward. Mm.
Kate's just doing a little bit of a yoga exercise here, aren't you? Are you all right there?
I do apologise. just some pain-related issues, which mean I am striking quite the pose at Simon right now.
Emily, Davis, have you got a question for Mandy?
Well, it's funny because I've recently been thinking about disability and depression a lot, but I've not ever been hospitalized for it. I don't know, Mandy, if you have a physical disability or not, but I know as someone with a physical disability that sometimes I tend to internalize that, and that's directly connected to depression. I mean, is that something that you've experienced before or something that you've encountered before?
I don't have a physical disability, but we had a few ladies on the ward who had physical disabilities, and we had a couple of ladies who had and I've forgotten the name of it. It's a long-term condition that causes pain. Fibromyalgia, is it, or something?
Fibromyalgia,
just where people are in constant pain and how that then affects their mental health. So physical and mental health are really, really closely related. Mental health problems can cause physical health problems. Physical health problems can cause mental health problems. Mm. So they're very interlinked. And there's so much nationally about this at the moment. So people with long-term mental health conditions die 10, 20 or 30 years younger than most other people. And that's from obesity or smoking-related problems or medication and other things. So one of the things that I've been referred to is to have a personal trainer and to have a year's free membership at a gym.
On the NHS?
No, it's not on the NHS. It's on Sports England. Sports England funded.
Quite aggressive there, Kate.
Yeah.
I was like, where's mine?
No. So I didn't know about this until... But what I've done is I've asked all the questions, and because I know how to navigate the system and who to ask, I will say, what else is available? How can I do that? Well, where can I do that? So I'm volunteering at a local mine charity shop, so I'm not just lying at home idle doing nothing, watching television, where the other patients might be doing that. I'm keeping myself busy every single day.
Amazing. Maybe we should implement a system where every NHS director has to go and spend time on their own wards.
It is back to the shop floor, isn't it? Yes, but all you've had is imply that you want to cause a lot of disability and impairment to a lot of people. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. Always.
So back to the shop floor. Most directors and most non-executive directors will go back to the ward.
Yeah.
But you will go onto the ward for half an hour and you will walk into the office and all the nurses will smile at you and half of the patients will be out and you're not there at 9 o'clock at night or 3 in the morning when there's a fight. Yeah. You know, it's very, very, very different.
Undercover NHS. Yeah. I can see it now. It's going to make me millions. Mandy, that was brilliant. Thank you so much for being so open and candid. And you're going to stay with us for the rest of the show.
Yes.
And if you have a story to tell, then do get in touch with us at bbc.co.uk.
Have you got a LinkedIn page?
No, I told you before, I don't understand LinkedIn.
I know, we need to sort that out, don't we?
Yeah, that's what I'm always being told. But, you know, I've got Facebook, I've got Twitter, I've got all the pages. Why do I need another one? I don't understand it. Anyway, take a listen to this. That's Delta 7 with The Jungle. Hear the track in full at the end of the show.
It's social media update time. Are you still with us, Emily?
I sure am.
Emily Laddow is a disability rights activist and writer from New York. So what's been happening on the internet this month?
So we have quite a lot going on in America, in case you haven't noticed recently.
I haven't. What's happening over there?
Oh, you know, just a little thing called the presidential election. Not a big deal.
Okay.
Our prime minister came to visit you.
Oh, and that is true, yes.
Thank you for having us. First story, Meryl Streep.
Yes. She made some headlines because she recently won an award, a Lifetime Achievement Award, to be specific, at the Golden Globes. And she used her acceptance speech time to call out our new president, Donald Trump. She specifically focused in on a rather old behavior of his, which happened back in 2015, where he mocked a reporter with a disability. Mm-hmm. The reporter's name is Serge Kovaleski. I think it's important to actually mention the name of the reporter so we humanize him a little bit. But Streep said that this incident of Donald Trump mocking the reporter really broke her heart and really upset her because he mocked someone who didn't have, she said, the privilege, power, or capacity to fight back. Obviously, this got the internet talking because anything having to do with Meryl Streep and Donald Trump will do that to you.
Mm-hmm.
There was sort of a split in opinion. So people like me were saying, you know, thanks Meryl Streep, but no thanks because this is an old event and why is it that disability seems to be the primary focus when we've got so many other instances of President Trump's egregious behavior. But then you have plenty of people saying, oh, but Meryl Streep was doing the right thing and her heart was in the right place. And thanks for mentioning disability on a primetime platform. So there was certainly a lot of dissent on social media. And there was a lot of back and forth as to whether Meryl Streep was to be commended or whether she really didn't do anything particularly noteworthy.
There's a phrase, don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. And what I mean by that is, of course, she kind of fluffed because she didn't mention any other ethnicity or what Trump talks about women. It was just disability. But that fact that heart in the right place, is that an insult really?
But I just kind of think she had a very limited amount of time and she was kind of talking about the moment that her heart broke. Gosh, she's talking about disability at the Golden Globes. What more do we want?
He's a journalist who won a Pulitzer Prize. It's not like he could have written. He's been conspicuously quiet. Why didn't he write a piece to... Where were you at on this, Emily?
When Kate said, what more do we want? I think the big thing that we want is not just to be an abstract concept in Meryl Streep's speech, but actually to have our own presence at the Golden Globes. You know, where are the actors with disabilities winning the awards? Where is our presence in Hollywood? And why is it that we're the ones who are pitied
to the point that
the worst thing he could do.
Peter Dinklage won a Golden Globe and he made a political statement by saying something's happened to a gentleman in England, his name is this, look it up on Google. So he nailed it, he identified the individual, he did it.
He's a prime example of disability in Hollywood in a way that doesn't make it all about disability all the time, but shows that we can still have a presence and that we can still speak out.
Kate looked at me all a bit bemused. She didn't know where to go with that one, Emily. No, I think we're winning.
I didn't know who you're talking about.
Oh my goodness, Peter Dinklage.
I know who Peter Dinklage is. I didn't know who the guy
the short guy who Peter Dinklage was referring to.
Yeah,
okay.
I didn't hear about it. Again,
well, that's how much you care about short people, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yet again.
Maybe it is. Or maybe that he didn't make headlines because he's Peter Dinklage, not Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep's making headlines about disability because she has a bigger platform. And isn't it great that we're talking about it?
But did she do anything to help us, really, other than sort of bring up an old incident? I mean, did she talk about... And granted, I know you said we had, you know, a limited amount of time for her to talk about anything, so I'm not expecting her to recite War and Peace on disability, but think about some of the big issues that are facing people with disabilities right now. You've got healthcare, you've got employment, so, you know, I don't want people to feel bad for me. I want them to be concerned about some of the impacts that the new administration might have on me.
Now, I'm sensing you're not a big fan, but there are disabled supporters of Trump. Is that right, Emily?
You'd be right in suggesting that I'm not a big fan. But I think it's also only fair to recognize that there are plenty of people with disabilities who were supporters of Donald Trump. And a lot of people, in fact, who didn't even want disability to factor into how they voted. So it's certainly important to remember that people can support either side regardless of having a disability.
Louise.
Disabled chicken.
Yes. What is this about Louise, the disabled rooster? Please tell
me. We really need to talk about something happy, and what is happier than Louise, the disabled rooster? There is nothing happier.
I mean, what is it? Who is she?
Louise is not a she. Louise is a he.
Okay.
Louise was presumed female at birth. and apparently had a sibling named Thelma. Thelma did not make it, but Louise thrived, and it was soon discovered that Louise was a rooster and not a chicken. And Louise was born with a disability, specifically a leg deformity, but a staffer at the at-risk animal organization where Louise was really wanted to find a way to make mobility possible for him. So he actually found a company that made custom wheelchairs for animals.
Amazing.
So they got this custom avian wheelchair, and now Louise is just living happily ever after and going all over the place in her little bird wheelchair, or his little bird wheelchair, my apologies for misgendering the rooster.
I mean, I just love that there's a company out there that makes animal wheelchairs.
Isn't that great?
That makes the world a better place.
I looked at the photo of the rooster in the wheelchair and it made me laugh out loud. It's hilarious.
It's a really adorable wheelchair too. I think it's bright blue and just very cheerful.
Yeah, it doesn't look very solid, though. It looks a little bit flimsy.
It looks a little bit wobbly, but what do you want for a rooster?
Yeah, and is it self-propelling or is it electric? I wasn't quite sure.
It looks to me like it's self-propelling just to sort of keep Louise from falling over.
Amazing. Well, I mean, now we're back on safe territory, aren't we, everyone? Good work. Emily, you came to our attention when you wrote for the New York Times about your relationship with your mum, who has the same impairment. What is your impairment, and what's it like living with a mum who has the same impairment and also uses a power chair?
Yeah, so we both have Larson syndrome. It's a genetic joint and muscle disorder, and it affects both of us differently. But most people seem to think that having multiple family members with a disability is just the most depressing thing. But I think that could not be further from the truth. I think we understand each other better than anyone else, and we're so close, and we're able to help each other out, and the things that she can't do, I can do, and some things that I can't do, she can do. So I think it's a gift, as cheesy as that is. We get on really well. She's my best friend, and I wouldn't have it any other way. So now that you've gotten your daily sappiness in.
Nice. Well, Emma, you have two blind siblings.
I do. We're like the three blind mice.
What was that like growing up with?
Actually, it was really good because it was really, really helpful. You know, when I was four, I was told that I was going to become blind in my mid to late teens. So I was the oldest out of the three. And as I started losing my sight and my brother and sister started losing their sight, it became kind of like fun. We were able to talk about it, like, you know, oh, I just got back from school today and, you know, I crashed into this post and I thought it was a real person, so I apologised, but then I felt really silly because it wasn't a real person. And then my brother saying, oh, I did the same, actually. But joking aside, you know, you're not then alone. And I think it's helpful.
Mandy, is that what you... Mandy, you're nodding.
Yeah, no, I was trying to imagine what it was like for you and for your siblings and for your parents as well with this with the news, and just you know, how that's going to affect the way you think and feel and about your relationship. So, wow. So you became blind before your brother and sister?
Yes. So, I mean, you know, I was in my mid to late teens. Suddenly I woke up one morning and I couldn't see the picture hanging opposite the end of my bed. And I remember that day just walking around, crashing into, you know, things. And, you know, I remember my mum having to sell my bike, you know, because I couldn't see to ride it. And there was a lot of things like that. And, you know, I guess I hit rock bottom, Mandy, but... then I was at uni, so there wasn't much time to feel sad. I was like, right, I've got exams coming up in 2 months. I can't read my books. I've got to do something. So it was more pragmatic.
Was there support for you when you were at uni, when you were going through this?
There was a support unit, but I was studying maths and finance, and there wasn't much in the way of you know, materials to help me with that. So I had to carve my own path. Like, you know, I got people to read maths, but no one could read maths with all the brackets.
I was
going
to say, that is a tricky decision to make, choosing to do maths when you know you're going to go blind.
Yeah, I mean, I had decided when I was really young I wanted to enter into the financial world, You know, I used to work in my parents' shop, and when I gave out the correct change, the you know, ladies used to say, "Oh, whoa, what a clever boy!" And I thought, "Wow, I am actually. This is, you know, what I want to do." And I didn't want to change my path, so I decided to keep going with the finance.
We've had a lovely chat with you already, Amal. Before we formally introduce you, Emily, you also do a podcast. Just give a little plug for that.
We have the guy-girl thing going on too, that dynamic. So I apologize for taking that from you guys, but you had it first. Don't worry.
Great. Good. As long as we were there first, that's fine.
So the podcast that I work on is called The Accessible Stall, and I do it with one of my best friends, Kyle Khachaturian, and it is a podcast that tackles disability issues from two very unique perspectives, and whatever we are talking about, we always keep it honest and real. So that is The Accessible Stall.
What is The Accessible Stall? I'm thinking you buy hot dogs at it in New York.
The Accessible Stall is actually the name for the accessible bathroom.
Oh, hello.
Or toilet. Yeah, so you know how some people will sit in a restroom and have a conversation and shoot the breeze and things like that?
I didn't know that.
No.
Or, okay, maybe this is an American thing.
What, you just start talking to the person in the next cubicle?
No, when you're washing your hands and fixing your hair.
It's a girl thing.
Is it?
Yeah. It's a girl thing, except I do the podcast with a guy, so what are you going to do? But, yeah, so that is where the name The Accessible Stall came from, because we just thought it was a bit humorous, because that's the place where you can kind of catch up and do a little bit of gossiping and talk about all the serious stuff that you wouldn't talk about outside the bathroom.
And your co-host has an excellent name, Kyle Khachaturian. Sounds so
yeah,
cool.
He's wonderful, and you should hear him talk also. I mean, his voice is
amazing. Okay, fine. Yep. We will grudgingly put a link to it on our website.
It might make it very small, and Amar will make it inaccessible so blind people can't see it. So, not many people pick up on it.
It's the effort that's appreciated.
Thank you, Emily. Amar, we've already had lots of lovely conversations with you, but you're actually on the show to promote your show. You're the presenter of Channel 4's How to Get Fit Fast with Anna Richardson. So what's it all about?
On the show, I'm busting myths with Anna about fitness. You know, whether running on the road is really bad for your knees, and how do you get that amazing body? You know, because, you know, don't get me wrong, you know, I go to the gym, but, you know, I've not got that amazing body. So I'm just a regular gym goer. How can I get that, you know, perfect bod?
You looked into bulking and shredding. What's that about?
Right. Bulking and shredding. Basically, for 3-4 months of the year, you bulk. And that's where you eat loads of food. So, you know, you're eating about 4,000 calories.
God, I'm really good at that bit.
Yeah, but that's what I thought. You know, I thought straight to eating donuts and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But you've got to eat the right things. So lots of chicken, lots of eggs, etc. So you eat 4,000 calories when normally you'd eat about 2,000. And then you do a lot of heavy weights. And that's when you're really bulking up. So you suddenly become really big. And then comes the shredding. That's when you're, for the next few months, you lower your calorie count. So you're eating only 1,500 calories or 1,000, and you're doing lots of cardio stuff. So you lose the fat, and guess what? Under that fat should be some beautiful muscles.
They've got you on the show doing the blind cliche. They've got you touching people. Is that right, to find the definition?
No, they haven't got me doing anything, actually, like that. The great thing about Channel 4 is the programme wasn't anything to do with my blindness, but here you've got a presenter talking about exercise and, oh, you know, by the way, he's blind.
Okay.
And this is what's cool, because, you know, so at the beginning, the viewer doesn't know that I'm blind and I'm interviewing people and walking around and doing the exercise and stuff. And suddenly you see my cane and you think, oh, OK. And I think that's quite a nice way to do it.
But how did you find out what you were aiming for? Because obviously you couldn't see the pictures that, you know, a lot of people look at on Instagram for inspiration.
Oh, I have people describe things. You know, it's a bit like, you know, you go into a bar, you know, I can't see the girls. I get people to describe them for me. It's a visual world. And, you know, I guess sight is one of the senses, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, on the programme, you'll see me a bit more hands-on than, I guess, Anna Richardson. So yeah, I mean, if you can't see the muscles, prove them to me. And the only way I can do that is I have to touch.
So did you get bulked and shredded then?
I didn't know. Oh. So, you know, we made the programme over a number of weeks, so there wasn't enough time for me to...
But I was going to say, that would be too much of a commitment. Who's got time for all of that? Months of overeating, then shred...
They did get you running.
Yes, so the other thing that I was presenting was running. So I was speaking to Jack Maitland, the coach of the Brownlee brothers, and I was talking about running with him, and I was talking to some of the athletes and seeing what they do. And then I'm chatting to this actual scientist to find out the real science behind running and whether, you know, it's bad for your joints, because you get a lot of people saying, oh, I don't want to go running because I don't want to do my joints and etc. So, you know, through this program, you'll really get a good idea what is fact and what is not.
But it's
not.
There are programs of disability show, so I do need to ask, as a blind person running, was that easy? Was that a bit tricky? do you do it a lot anyway?
Well, I do it, and I do it at the gym. And, you know, gym equipment is so inaccessible. Even the modern stuff is just horrendous. Nothing speaks to you, nothing. You've got all these touch screens. So on the programme, they got me running on a treadmill, but it wasn't any old treadmill. It was like fitted with all the, you know, measurements and stuff like that. And it didn't have anywhere where I could actually link onto. So what I did was I just strapped my cane horizontally in front of me, and I used that to tap my hands against it so that I could run.
So why do you need to link something?
I guess when you're blind and you're running on a running machine, it's really hard. Like, you've got no point of reference, so you could easily slide back and fall off and do a few cartwheels, etc., and then land in a heap on the floor.
Great TV.
Yep.
That's it. It would make great TV, actually. Maybe that's where I went wrong. I should have done that. Or I might have done that, actually. But it was really funny. There was one bit where the scientist said, right, all I need you to do is really simple task, Ammer. He was Irish, Brian Henley. He goes, all I need you to do is just run in a straight line. And so it was, I tried to run in a straight line, but I couldn't. I mean, I didn't realise that that was going to be my biggest... It was, I mean, literally, you're talking, all I had to do was run for like 4 or 5 metres in a straight line.
You'd think that was the simplest thing in the world.
Exactly.
So, Emma, you're a travel buff. You love travel and you've created your company. But I hear that one of your biggest problems with travel is the in-flight entertainment. That annoys
you. Absolutely.
Good question.
Yes.
Why?
Because, I mean, it's so inaccessible. Like, I've just come back yesterday from the lovely Seychelles. We were flying with this, you know, well-known airline, and they've got this brand spanking new entertainment system, and it was all touch screen, and you can't access any of it at all. And this really, really frustrates me. So, you know, the next thing I want to do is raise awareness and get this sorted once and for all. British Airways has made good progress. I complained loads and loads about audio description on the in-flight entertainment. And now, you know, it's great. You know, when you go on one of the BA flights, you know, you can have a film audio described to you.
So that's where they tell you what's happening, the bits that you can't see, they describe it.
Exactly. They describe everything, even the, you know, the little naughty bits as well.
So that's the first thing we thought of, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The first thing.
Yeah.
No, it's. I thought you were thinking that maybe. But, like, when your friends are describing it, or, you know, strangers are describing it, like, you know, on our holidays, you have a sighted person that gets partnered with a visually impaired person. And, you know, it's really embarrassing. So they don't describe some of the those bits.
Yeah.
You know, like, recently we were in Pompeii. And in Pompeii, there's this 2,000-year-old brothel. And everybody visits it. And you've got all these, like, explicit frescoes above doors. And, you know, we've had, like, this 60-year-old sighted UN worker saying to her 23-year-old young female professional, actually, you don't really want me to describe them, do you? Shall we go for a cup of tea instead?
What do you do when the entertainment on flights aren't accessible? Do you get tell the air stewards to ask them, you know, you're constantly saying, can you come and change the movie? Can you come and do this? Or do you just sit there annoyed? Do you take your own iPad full
listen
of films?
Listen to the Ouch podcast.
Yep, on repeat over and over.
Well, I've got a piece of advice for my fellow visually impaired people out there. I take my own laptop on board and I set an economy. And because the charge is only like 3 hours, and if there aren't any plugs in economy, I've said to the in-flight attendant, you know, is it possible that you could charge my laptop for me? And she says, oh, well, we can charge it, but it's in business class. And I said, oh, could you do it? And they say, like, but we can't leave it on charge by itself, so you'll have to come and sit there.
Oh, sneaky.
And sneaky. Yeah, and it takes a while for it to charge up. But yeah.
This is why you run Travelize, the travel company for blind people. And besides top tips like that, what it's about, what's its the key to its success?
Well, I set up Travelize back in 2004, you know, because I was blind and I wanted to see the world. And, you know, group travel companies just said, look, you can't come on a trip. You know, you've got to bring somebody with you. And I just wanted to be free and independent. And so what Travelize does is it enables blind and visually impaired people from actually all over the world. You know, we have customers in America and Canada and Australia and New Zealand. It enables blind people to travel independently on their own terms. But unlike the other companies, we don't exclude the fully sighted folk.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, nice touch.
Yeah, so they come on the trips, and in return for guiding and describing, you know, they get to travel for, you know, less. So a blind person gets a fully guided service at a competitive price, and sighted people get to do this. It levels the playing field. But the main thing is, we're all on holiday, whether you're blind or you're sighted.
I've also done a bit of organized travel with people who have physical disabilities as well. So I sometimes find that being with other people in the moment and experiencing it can sometimes make it a bit more fun when you're all sort of in the same boat. Did you feel like that was the case?
Yeah, it's just amazing, like, how, you know, you get people from all walks of life coming into a group and how, you know, they gel so well together. But what we do is we swap partners each day.
All right.
Oh, hello. So,
not that kind of stuff, but each day a different blind person is guided by a different sighted person. And so it keeps the group fresh and, you know, you get to meet lots of people.
Thank you so much, Amar. Do you know when your program's going to be on?
Yes, I do. The programme will be aired the 7th of February at 8 p.m.
That's Channel 4.
Channel 4.
Thank you, Amar. We'll definitely be tuning into that one. And thank you, Mandy.
My pleasure. It's lovely to be here.
And thank you, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for the February 2017 Ouch Talk show. The producer today was Emma Tracy and the studio manager was James Birtwistle.
Music this month is by Delta 7, a seven-piece rock band from Eastbourne who all have learning disabilities. Here's their debut single, The Jungle.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. What's up?